In a Japanese bestseller of the 1920s, If Japan and America Fight, Lieutenant General Kojiro Sato predicted that America's colored people would not be willing to take up arms to defend the United States if a war broke out. The author could not have been more incorrect. Before the war, the editors of the Baltimore Afro-American promised President Roosevelt that, should the country need them, black people would put aside their historic grievances and do their part. "Mr. President, you can count on us," they promised. However, the editors added that they could not be expected to defend their country with a whisk broom and a wide grin. The truth was that although every branch of service desperately needed men, neither the Army, nor the Marines, nor the Navy wanted black men.
As the U.S. entered World War II, why did African American men join the military, and what were their experiences once they did? I'm Norman Gilliland.
And I'm Emily Auerbach. This is University of the Year.
What prompted 50 black sailors to mutiny in 1944? And why did Eleanor Roosevelt get involved in their trial? What circumstance brought white and African-American soldiers together in combat? Our guest is James Campbell, whose previous book, The Ghost Mountain Boys, followed the footsteps of American soldiers in a treacherous trek across New Guinea. His latest book is The Color of War, How One Battle Broke Japan and Another Changed America. It was published in 2012 by Crown.
Oh, welcome to University of the Air.
Thank you very much. I'm happy to be here.
What made you decide in The Color of War to focus on two separate events, both occurring in July 1944?
Well, I'll try not to give you a very long-winded answer. When I was retracing the route of the Ghost Mountain Boys across New Guinea in 2006, after that trek, I was exhausted and I was recuperating in Port Moresby. And I was talking to some professors at the University of Port Moresby, born and raised on New Guinea. And they said, and I was telling them about my project, and they said, "Well, have you ever heard of the 96 Engineers?" And I said, "No, I've never heard of the 96 Engineers." So I came home and I started researching. It was a black engineering unit that built roads and airfields and wharfs all over the island of New Guinea during the war. And I'd never read anything about them. And I came back and tried to do some research, and I found almost nothing about them. And then I started looking at the records of black participation in World War II, and there was almost no oral or written history. I had signed a two-book contract with Random House Crown, and my first book, by contract, had to be a World War II book. And I thought, well, wouldn't it be interesting to put together two stories, one story about the heroic World War II that we all know, about the greatest generation and the good war, and tell a story about the good war's ugly underbelly, a story that doesn't fit the narrative and doesn't fit the mythology and very few Americans know about. And I think Studs Terkel called it the good war,
right,
in the good war's ugly underbelly. And that's what it turned out to be. Racism in America, particularly in the military at the time, was rampant and pervasive.
Can you give us a kind of a backstory for American military experiences with black troops? I mean, it goes all the way back to the American Revolution and certainly in the Civil War.
Right. Well, blacks, when used in combat, performed very ably, which really perplexed me. I thought, you know, they had a record, a wonderful record in the War of 1812, in the Civil War, in World War I, a record of heroism and sacrifice. Teddy Roosevelt credited them with saving his life in Cuba. And it made no sense to me why the military... Well, blacks served in World War I, and then as soon as World War I was over, blacks were no longer allowed to serve in the military. It made no sense to me whatsoever.
You include in your book some quotations that are chilling for how racist they are.
Yeah, all the military leaders of the time, the Secretary of War Stimson, Army Chief of Staff Marshall, Secretary of the Navy Knox, were adamantly opposed to using blacks in any capacity initially, and certainly in combat. Marshall said that this is racism as a situation that has perplexed America since its founding,
right,
and we will not undergo or indulge in a social experiment. There were many others said the blacks were simply not up to the task, that they were intellectually inferior, and it was obviously blatant racism at work.
Do you think it was fear in part? That, I mean, there's always been this dilemma of arming people who are being discriminated and oppressed.
Wasn't that the great nightmare of if not all of white America, certainly parts of white America, that you'd hand these black radicals weapons and, you know, God knows what they'd do.
You'd train them
and then there'd be an uprising. Yeah, so I think that there was a very pervasive fear of, you know, kind of the black bogeyman in his rifle.
Was the United States beefing up its military when the war in Europe broke out? Were we already starting to ramp up under the Roosevelt administration? And so was the manpower need already growing?
Oh, yeah. The manpower need, I think, well before we actually entered the war, everyone agreed that we would probably be going to war. And the NAACP made it known very early on in 1939 or 1940. They wrote to the president and said, "President, we will serve. We are Americans and we will fight for our country, but we demand to serve as equals." And 24 hours after Pearl Harbor, the NAACP wrote President Roosevelt again and said, "Though we have more often than not been deprived the privileges of democracy, this is our country and we would like to fight, but we would like to fight as equals."
But were they okay with separate but equal units?
No, they weren't. They were separate but equal in the Navy meant they'd serve as chambermaids and mm-hmm. bellhops and dishwashers. And no, they equated the right to fight with citizenships. It was a powerful symbol of injustice for them not to be given the right to fight. And it was reminiscent or a reminder of their status as second-class citizens.
In your book, you tell quite a few narratives where you give the account of a black man who decides to enlist and has a dream of how it's going to be, only to discover how disillusioning it can be if you're assigned dirty, menial labor and you're not even going to get to go on a ship.
Dirty menial labor for which you have not been trained at all. In the case of the Port Chicago Naval Ammunition Depot, where these men were handling highly explosive ordnance and hadn't been trained in the least. But yes, I managed to find probably a dozen of the Port Chicago sailors, and they all, maybe down to the last man, said that they had this grand dream of serving aboard a battleship or a destroyer and fighting for their country, fighting as true patriotic Americans, only to realize that when they went to the Great Lakes Naval Training Center in Waukegan, Illinois, their training was subpar, it was segregated, and after that, they were merely being sent to the naval depots.
Well, it was certainly a legitimate complaint, but we can't overlook entirely the frequency of lack of training. I mean, you know, Stephen Ambrose mentions in, I think it's Band of Brothers, the 18-year-olds who went out into the foxholes without enough training, and many didn't last the day.
That's true. In the Ghost Mountain Boys, I focused on the 32nd Division, which is largely from the Midwest, and those men were sent to New Guinea. They thought they were going to Europe. They arrived in New Guinea with World War I wool leggings and nothing to prevent malaria. They'd never trained in the jungles or swamps in the mountains, and they were the guinea pigs of the South Pacific. That's what they called themselves. So, yes, there were many cases of lack of training or undertraining on behalf of the men who fought in World War II. But never was there a case, or maybe I don't say, shouldn't say it categorically, but I don't know of a case where the lack of training that was given to these men was deliberate.
Well, let's get to Port Chicago and that whole arrangement and how deliberate then and why would it be deliberate not to train these men how to do dangerous work? If they, I mean, why would you make a conscious effort not to train them?
Well, perhaps it was deliberate in that there was not the time to train these people. There was a two ocean war going on at the time. In fact, the Secretary of the Navy, Frank Knox, said that if Roosevelt tried to integrate the Navy, he would promptly resign. He said it was injurious to morale and injurious to efficiency. So There was certainly an issue of time going on. They had to load these Victory and Liberty ships that were bound for the Central Pacific in the war in the Southwest Pacific. So they weren't able to train these men. And whether or not it was actually deliberate, that perhaps was not the proper choice of words. But nevertheless, these men weren't trained when subsequent companies that were sent to Port Chicago should have been trained, knowing what was happening at Port Chicago, knowing the kind of ordnance they were handling.
Langston Hughes has a poem called Expendable about how black soldiers were treated as expendable, as if their lives did not have the same value. Maybe that's what you're saying in terms of, you know, in terms of giving them training, that it just wasn't thought as necessary as it would have been.
Right. Had they been infantrymen or had they been serving aboard a destroyer or a battleship, they would have been thoroughly trained in many cases, in most cases, certainly later on in the war. But no, the ordnance men weren't trained. There was no ammunition handling manual whatsoever. So they were handling thin-walled depth charges, and they were handling highly combustible Torpex-loaded bombs, and they didn't know what they were doing. The Torpex-loaded bombs that came with a notice that said, "We'll go off on impact." and they had no training. They had no notion of how to move these bombs.
And it was Port Chicago, which, of course, the name implies that it was near Chicago, but it was actually closer to San Francisco by a long shot.
40 miles northeast of San Francisco on the Sacramento River.
What kind of facility was that?
Well, the men that I interviewed, the African-American sailors that I interviewed, they said when they first saw it, they thought it was the most desolate place they'd ever seen in their lives. They described it as a plantation system with white overseers and black workers who had no chance of promotion. You know, they weren't able to strike for higher ratings. It was a dead end for them, and they recognized that very quickly.
It was also shocking how little they got paid.
Yeah, that's right. That was part of it. And because of that, the depots across the country, but especially Port Chicago, because it became the main depot for the shipment and storage of ammunition for the South Pacific, they became hotbeds of discontent, disillusioned African-American sailors who realized that they weren't going anywhere and they weren't going to learn skills that they could use later on in life. They were being paid poorly and they were doing work that nobody else wanted to do.
They're put in a really tough spot from the standpoint of public opinion, aren't they? Because in wartime, the snap judgment would be that you're being unpatriotic if you somehow don't do your job, whatever job that is and however dirty that might be. But on the other hand, they were not getting what they thought they needed in order to keep doing the job.
Right. Well, the white sailors and soldiers complained that the blacks weren't shedding their blood on the battlefield, but the African-American sailors and soldiers wanted to. As I said before, they equated it with full citizenship. They were willing, they were very willing to do that. And that certainly was the case.
And so Port Chicago is specifically a munitions loading depot?
Yeah, they built it 1 week after Pearl Harbor. They were searching for an ammunition depot on the West Coast prior to the war that could serve the needs of the Navy. The whole kind of amphibious doctrine was built on massive naval gunfire. And they knew that they were going to be shipping lots of ordnance through Port Chicago. So they found 640 acres. Just northeast of Richmond, California, on the Sacramento River, 1 week after Pearl Harbor, and began to build the depot.
It sounds as if some people knew that it was highly volatile and said it was going to blow to kingdom come. That there were those who were warning something was going to blow up.
Well, many of the black sailors that I interviewed said they repeatedly told the lieutenants in charge of their divisions that they were working too quickly, that they were working with no kind of standards of protection, that they weren't handling these bombs properly. But the Navy explicitly built it to minimize the dangers of an accidental explosion. It was not near any major population centers. So when the explosion did happen, I realize I'm kind of getting ahead of the game. The Navy considered it kind of affirmation, ironically,
that
they had done things right.
There had been a notorious incident back in 1917 during World War I when two munitions, or at least one of them was a munition ship, collided and killed 3,000 people.
In Halifax, Nova Scotia, right. Right.
And so the Navy, I gather, was aware of that and wanted to keep this a little more off the beaten path.
Yeah. Well, it was across the Sacramento River just outside of what's called Sassoon Bay. And there were a couple little towns within the vicinity. But had that explosion occurred across the river, for instance, at Mare Island near Concord, or closer to San Francisco Bay, the death toll would have been maybe incalculable.
So how many black sailors were handling these munitions at Port Chicago?
Well, as many in 1944, the spring of 1944, as many as 1,000. They were working 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. There were eight divisions. Initially, they worked 12-hour days before Great Lakes out of Waukegan, Illinois, shipped more men, and then eventually 8 hours a day.
12 hours a day handling munitions that were highly explosive.
Yeah, highly explosive, right.
That 11th, 12th hour could get pretty hairy, I would think.
Yeah. And what kind of relationships between the white officers and the black men doing the work?
Well, I hate to demonize all the white officers. You know, that's probably is kind of silly to do that. But the relationships were largely poor. There were some white officers, and the men, you know, named them when I interviewed them. But largely they felt, as they described many times, they felt like slaves. And slaves in that, regardless of how hard they worked, their situations were not going to change. Soldiers and sailors serving in other capacities knew that they would be rewarded with higher ratings or better salaries if they performed their jobs ably and responsibly.
Ultimately, then, what happened at Port Chicago?
There was an explosion, as many of the African-American sailors said there would be on July 17th, 1944, on the very day, getting back to your initial question, that Admiral Nimitz and Admiral King were celebrating the victory on Saipan.
Things obviously got blown to smithereens, but do we have any idea what happened?
There are many, many theories. One theory by a man named Peter Vogel, he advanced the theory some years ago that it was a deliberate detonation, that the Navy deliberately detonated the ship. I talked to some physicists that said that they were testing a low-yield atomic bomb, and that was the best place to test it. I lead perhaps with the most incendiary example, but what I could figure is that probably what happened was that one of the booms snapped.
And
one of the booms snapped. They had a net of of 6 tons, carrying 6 tons of projectiles or bombs. At the time, they had added another ton to the nets to speed up the process, and one of those booms might have broken.
Stressing the specs.
But they investigated. There was a court of inquiry, and they investigated sabotage and lots of other possibilities.
And the consequence, how many deaths?
Well, 320 men died, 202 of them black sailors. So many, many white officers also died. 390 were injured, including 233 black African-American sailors.
And if the case had not gone on to lead to charges of mutiny, would it still be a famous incident?
That's really interesting. Well, the book begins with an incident at Westlock. Just prior to the invasion, almost nobody knows about this. There was an enormous explosion at Pearl Harbor in late May of 1944 in the Westlock Channel. And it was not revealed until, or not confirmed by the military until the 1960s. So I guess to answer your question, probably not. Had it not led to mutiny, we might not know about it. We might not have known about it until, you know, late in the century.
We'll hear about the mutiny, the Port Chicago mutiny, and what its ramifications and repercussions were when we return in a moment. This is University of the Air. I'm Norman Gilliland, back with Emily Auerbach, and our guest, James Campbell, the author of The Color of War, How One Battle Broke Japan and Another Changed America. And we've looked at this enormous disaster that took place near San Francisco at Port Chicago, July 17, 1944, when a large amount of explosive material exploded, and largely, we assume, because the Navy was kind of pushing the safety margin there, but we'll never know 100% what happened or why it happened. We have a good idea what happened. But before we get into the resulting trial and the mutiny that we've talked about, how big was this explosion at Port Chicago?
It was enormous. The E.A. Bryan was carrying at the time over 6,000 tons of ordnance, and the explosion, which happened just after 10 p.m. on July 17th, exploded with one quarter the explosive fury of the bomb dropped on Hiroshima, 2.25 kilotons of TNT.
Goodness, and all on one ship?
All on one ship.
Is this shattering windows in San Francisco or something?
Yes. In Berkeley, the seismograph was set off and recorded two low-level earthquakes, and that was 40 miles away, and there were 150-mile-an-hour winds. Car-size chunks of metal were flying 9,000 feet in the air. I interviewed a demolitions expert and a physicist that said, had that explosion occurred above the water level in instead of below the water level, so the ordnance was in the belly of the ship, so it blew down instead of up. But had it blown up, the death toll would have been dramatically higher.
Now, it's 1944. The war is still very much full throttle. We've had this terrible accident, hundreds of sailors and officers killed. But the war goes on. You still have to load munitions and get them out to the Pacific.
Right. So the white officers who survived were given 21-day survivor's leave. The black sailors were offered nothing, no survivor's leave, no type of counseling of any sort, not even any counseling with a chaplain. On August 8th, they were taken across the river to Mare Island, which was a naval ammunition depot. And on August 8th, a ship docked there, and they were marched out to the parade grounds, and they were hoping that they were not going to take this turn toward the ship. And when they took the turn toward the ship, they stopped. The lieutenant said, you know, right face or something to that extent, and they all stopped in their tracks. And they knew at that point that they were going to be made to load ammunition again. And the men that I talked to said that they were, in some cases, though they didn't like the work, they were proud sailors. They had obeyed orders, and they were not in the habit of disobeying orders, but they were there was this horrible fear of ordnance, which is understandable.
And these were the same sailors who had been involved in the previous blast.
They were the same sailors.
And they were being told 3 or whatever, 4 weeks later, here's another ship, go to it.
3 weeks later, they were told that they would be loading ordnance again. The same sailors, those who weren't still in the hospital, were asked to load again. And 258 of them declined.
And did they do so in a sort of concerted effort where they had been talking among themselves or, you know, because whenever you hear of a sort of an action where it involves a lot of people, you wonder how they sort of all knew to act as a block.
Right. Well, that was the great question of the trial that followed, whether they acted collectively or individually. The prosecuting attorney said collective insubordination is mutiny. The defense attorney said that mutiny implies a conspiracy to overthrow or usurp authority, and that was not what they intended to do. They said they would do anything else but go back to loading ships.
And these days we hear a lot about PTSD, and there's much more understanding of it. But even in World War I, they were talking about shell-shocked vets. Was there not an awareness of the effect that that initial blast would have had on these men?
Well, no, I don't think that there was of any kind. As I said, you know, they received no type of counseling of any sort, even from the base chaplain. But I think PTSD was probably largely neglected throughout all of World War II. I know that the Ghost Mountain Boys that I interviewed for my last book, many of them have, you know, they're not in their 90s. Many of them have nightmares to this day. So I don't know that would have been terribly unusual. But they were not given survivor's leaves, and that's what they pointed out. The white officers were that had survived mm-hmm. the explosion, and they were not.
Now, mutiny is an offense. I think it's quite rare, actually, in the U.S. military, isn't it?
It's the only mutiny charge, I think, that had ever mass mutiny charge that had ever been made.
Does come with a potential death penalty, though.
Comes with a death penalty, which the admiral, the commandant of the 12th Naval District, pointed out to them. 3 days later, he was brought. He, by the way, earlier he had commended all the sailors at Port Chicago for how they conducted themselves on the evening of the blast. A number of them were sent to. There were these barricaded sidings where there were hundreds of railroad cars loaded with ammunition, and two of them were on fire. And a number of them went over there with hoses and put out the fires, clearly risking their lives. Many of the others risked their lives that night. But 2 days after the alleged mutiny, the admiral came and said, you know, the failure to obey an order during war is a mutinous charge, and the hazards of facing a firing squad are much greater than those of handling ammunition.
I think, as it turned out, there was only one soldier executed by firing squad during World War II, Private Slovak, I think.
I wasn't aware of that.
But in any event, what does the prosecution ask for then, and what does the defense ask for?
And do they take these men off? Do they do a mass arrest then?
Yeah, they did a mass arrest the day, I think it was August 11th when the admiral came. The admiral stood before him, gave him this speech, and said, "You will be put before a firing squad told this to 258 men. And he said, we'll now give you a chance to not indulge in this mutiny, to, you know, collect yourselves and to go back to work. And eventually, I mean, many of them were going through this kind of tortuous process of trying to make up their minds. Do they stand firm against what they believe was an injustice, or do they go back to work? Ultimately, 208 of the men did, leaving 50 behind. And those were the 50 that were tried. And again, I'm kind of getting ahead of the story, but eventually Thurgood Marshall, as you know, took over their appeal, and he said it was a show trial. 50 black sailors, it was used as a symbolic number. And he said it militates against our entire system of jurisprudence that we would try a group of 50 sailors as opposed to trying each sailor individually. Sorry to get ahead.
And so once we get these 50 sailors accused on trial. It's a military trial, obviously.
It's a military trial before a military court, yes.
What is the prosecution asking for, and what is the defense's strategy? I know you've hinted already at some of the defense's strategy.
Well, the prosecution said that there was collective insubordination meant mutiny. And they what they spent a lot of time doing was trying to define what mutiny meant. And mutiny has had a variety of different traditions in military history. There were kind of the shifting sands, you know, of mutiny. And the prosecution had admitted, or the court had allowed the prosecution to admit a lot of hearsay evidence, which the defense attorney, Lieutenant Veltman, objected to throughout the course of the trial, that the words of one could be held against the group, the entire 50 men. And Lieutenant Veltman, the defense attorney, was primarily concerned with that issue of throwing out that evidence, and also the issue of trying to prove that they were activated by mass fear but were not intent on overthrowing anything.
How would you say the media coverage was going? I mean, you include some headlines along the way. You know, how did you find that the trial was perceived?
Well, the black press, of course, this became kind of a cause célèbre for the black press, the Baltimore African-American, the Pittsburgh Courier, the Chicago Defender. But lots of other papers covered it, the New York Times, the San Francisco Chronicle. And the reporting by, let's say, kind of the traditional white newspapers was largely objective throughout the course of the trial. But at the end, that changed slightly. The sentences that were handed down were extraordinarily harsh, and members of the white press spoke against not only the conviction, but even more the sentences.
Where does it go from there, though? I mean, do the regulations, precautions for handling munitions change at all?
Well, they finally arrived. They've been almost non-existent before. The Navy did not publish a complete comprehensive manual for handling ammunition until 1945, until the summer of 1945, when the war was virtually over. And they kind of obliquely referred to this incident, this explosion, but never named it, never called it by name, never said where it happened, never said what happened, but continually said, well, we have learned from this incident, this large explosion, that the projectiles have to be handed this way, that detonators have to be shipped independent of the ordnance, that hot cargo can never be allowed to collect on a pier where ships are being loaded.
When you look at the transcript of the trial and the verdicts and so on, anything strike you now looking at it that seemed out of line?
Well, I was surprised by how aggressive Lieutenant Commander Coakley was, the prosecuting attorney, and how aggressive he was allowed to be throughout the course of the trial. I'm not a lawyer, but I'd talked to the Navy judge advocates about the trial, naval law scholars, and I was surprised by the evidence that was allowed to be admitted.
Really? What? Such as?
Well, the hearsay evidence, the head, Hugo Osterhaus, allowed to be admitted repeatedly on day after day after day. Lieutenant DeLucci reported that he had heard one man, his back was turned to the men, and he had heard someone say, "Don't go to work for the white," and then a vulgarity follows. And he was allowed to use that, the prosecuting attorney, as if it had come from the whole collection of men as opposed to one man.
Thurgood Marshall is sitting in the audience of the court at this time all the way through the trial?
Well, not through the entire trial. He came in early October. He had been alerted that there was this trial going on in California with the approval of the new Secretary of Navy, James Forrestal, who was a member of the Urban League. And Forrestal allowed Thurgood Marshall to sit in as an observer. And Marshall immediately saw the trial for what it was. He immediately saw that it was a show trial and immediately in the press put the Navy on trial and did quite a masterful job of, I think, generating publicity, negative publicity around what was happening in the mutiny trial.
You also mentioned Eleanor Roosevelt. What does she have to do with the story that you tell in the book?
Well, she was had arranged numerous meetings before the war began with her husband and civil rights leaders. And she clearly sympathized with their plight, with the plight of African Americans in the United States and also in the military. But she urged her husband, when the trial began, urged her husband to go easy on, as she said, the boys. But I don't think she meant that dismissively, but to go easy on the men, that they had obviously been activated by a horrible fear, and that in her opinion, they did not have any intention of committing mutiny.
It's ironic that the munitions that these black sailors were forced to handle to the detriment and the deaths of many of them, it's ironic that it was headed for Saipan.
Well, that was a connection that I tried to establish between Saipan, Port Chicago, and racism in America at the time. So you have Saipan, which was largely an unknown war in the Central Pacific. But Donald Miller, the very esteemed World War II historian, called Saipan as important to the war in the Central Pacific as Normandy was to the war in Europe. So I tried to make the connection between this really important battle, Saipan, and this ugly incident that had happened in Port Chicago. And the Port Chicago black sailors were loading ships that were bound for the invasion of Saipan. And shortly after Saipan was declared won, the Port Chicago naval ammunition exploded.
Well, the significance of Saipan was what? That this was actually the first time in the Pacific War that Allied forces had landed on an island that was occupied by the Japanese before the war. In
before
other words,
the war.
Yeah, this was not something they had taken. It had been given to them earlier.
That's exactly right. And Admiral Ernest King wanted Saipan for a number of different reasons, to cut off Japan from what was called its southern resource colony. He also recognized, as did Hirohito, by the way, in Tojo, that from Saipan, the United States could launch Superfortress B-29 bombers, could attack Japan with aircraft carriers and also long-range submarines. And Hirohito clearly recognized the danger of that.
And it had some 30,000 Japanese troops and a lot of Japanese civilians, too, on Saipan.
A lot of Japanese civilians and 30,000 troops, twice as many as the Marines had estimated would be defending the island. But when Hirohito, at the beginning of the battle, said, if we lose Saipan, hell will be upon us, he very clearly realized that the jeopardy that placed the nation of Japan in.
We're going to look at the Battle of Saipan when we continue in a moment with University of the Year. I'm Emily Auerbach, back with Norman Gilliland. Our guest is James Campbell, the author of The Color of War, which is looking at two events that took place in July 1944, the Port Chicago blast and explosion that led to a mutiny trial, and then also the Battle of Saipan as part of World War II. I noticed that one of the reviewers of your book was Harry Belafonte, and
yes,
he said that you're writing a powerful account of an important chapter of American history too little known until now.
Mm-hmm.
That's certainly true with the Port Chicago situation. It also seems to me that we know very little in general about this Battle of Saipan, that it doesn't get the same kind of attention that a lot of other battles do.
That's true. I just want to say one thing about Harry Belafonte. He was supposed to be sent to Port Chicago. So the whole Port Chicago incident was near and not very dear to his heart. So that's why he agreed to blurb the book. No, in the kind of pantheon of great Pacific battles, Saipan is not mentioned. We think of Guadalcanal, of course. We think of Peleliu. I'd like to think that after my last book, some people might think of the battle for New Guinea. We think of Okinawa. But the battle for Saipan was enormously important. And the fighting conditions on Saipan were miserable. And, lots of Marines fought very heroically and, suffered terribly on the island.
And who loaded their supplies on there for them?
The ships that allowed them to have massive naval gunfire that prepared the way for the Marines and also superior gunfire once they landed were the Port Chicago African-American sailors. But there were also Marines, African-American Marines involved. They were sent to Saipan, and their job was to unload the Liberty ships and the ships with unload ammunition from the ships and bring them to the invasion beaches. So the Marines had set up these depot and ammunition companies. So they were supply units for the Marine invasion forces.
So at least here they didn't, it may not be quite the right term, but at least they didn't necessarily have the most dangerous job in the neighborhood this time.
Well, they may have. Many of them were not equipped with rifles, and the Japanese were intent on not letting the Marines land. So they pounded the invasion beaches, and once the Marines had a foothold there, the Japanese continually attacked, and many of the African-American Marines were left to defend the ammunition caches, in some cases without weapons.
You write about how this Battle of Saipan is one of the grimmest battles. How so?
Yeah.
Tell us about what actually happened there.
Well, what happened at the end of the war was that the Japanese clearly recognized that they had lost Saipan, and they staged the largest banzai. In this case, it was called the Gaiakusai, and I'm not sure if I'm pronouncing that properly, the largest banzai charge of World War II. Thousands of Japanese, some who had been wounded, some who had bayonets attached to bamboo poles, attacked the Marine positions knowing full well that they were going to die. And bodies littered the northern portion of the island, choked the streams, and it was a horrific sight.
And they, nonetheless, despite your description of them, James, inflicted severe casualties on the American defenders.
They did very early on. The plan was to take Saipan in 6 days or a week, and Saipan lasted 21 days. So, yes, they inflicted lots of casualties on the Marines, and they also suffered from trench foot and a variety of other kind of tropical ailments. So they defended this island fiercely, and when it became apparent that they had lost it, they staged the Gyakusai.
And how many casualties on both the American and Japanese sides would you say there were?
I forget right now. Americans suffered over 10,000 casualties on Saipan, and the Japanese lost nearly 30,000 soldiers on Saipan.
Plus civilian suicides.
Plus military and civilian suicides. They went to the north portion of the island, and there they many of them held grenades and detonated them. There are cliffs on the north side of the island. Many of them jumped off the cliffs to their death. Both the Japanese soldiers and hundreds of citizens, both Japanese citizens and the Carolinian and Chamorro natives, because they had been told by the Japanese administration that the Marines would rape and maim them. So they jumped to their deaths. Whole families jumped to their deaths. In some cases, some historians have exaggerated it. Based on my research, some say thousands jumped to their deaths, thousands of citizens. I think the number is probably closer to 500.
How much did Hirohito have to do with the citizen suicides?
That's a good question. What he certainly had to do with was the military suicides. It was part of the Japanese ethic, that the soldiers' ethic, that they would not be taken prisoner. And I think 300 Japanese soldiers were taken prisoner.
Out of 30,000.
Out of 30,000 on Saipan.
And how significant was it to the Americans that they won the Battle of Saipan?
Well, enormously significant. Of course, the B-29s that after Saipan, they attacked the island just to the south, Tinian. And without having captured Saipan, they would not have been able to take Tinian. But the B-29s that dropped the bombs on Hiroshima and Nagasaki took off from there. But we had already firebombed all of Tokyo. Right. We had already blocked the ports. Taking off from Saipan, we'd already blocked the ports along the coast of Japan. So it was very important.
Well, let's look at the aftermath, both of this battle, but then also going back to the Port Chicago situation. Sometimes it takes 20, 30, 40 years for somebody to get a posthumous medal or for someone to be recognized or to have a memorial erected. Mm-hmm. What are some of the later things that have happened in conjunction with this July 1944?
Well, lots. I'll try to mention a few of them. In 1946, February of 1946, James Forrestal, the Secretary of Navy, largely because of Port Chicago, desegregated the Navy. Blacks were allowed positions throughout the naval force. So that was enormous. Truman, of course, desegregated all the armed forces in 1948. That did not happen immediately. He said the desegregation would happen, but it could not be injurious to efficiency or morale. By 1951 in North Korea, the army had desegregated. And by 1954, 250,000 black soldiers were fighting in integrated units. Port Chicago is now a National Historic Park. National Memorial and National Park, I think, are 392nd. And the black Marines, that 25,000 or 30,000 black Marines served in World War II, and the 300 who are left are being awarded the Congressional Gold Medal on June 27th in Washington, D.C. for their contributions to World War II, a medal they much deserved, obviously.
Do you know, did Coakley or anyone else representing the prosecution reflect back on this later and change his ideas at all about
Certainly
it?
Not Coakley. Coakley became the attorney, would it be the prosecuting attorney or attorney general for Alameda County? Is that what the position would be called? And he prosecuted many of the Vietnam objectors and many Black Panthers. So he certainly— He stayed consistent. So he certainly did not change. But what was later pointed out, interestingly, is that one of the members of the military court was the brother-in-law of Lieutenant DeLucci, who was the prime witness for prosecution during the mutiny trial. And that came out probably in the last decade. But what eventually happened, I didn't mention what the sentence for the 50 sailors
was. You just said it was very harsh.
Very harsh. They were broken to apprentice seamen. They were given sentences of 15 years confinement and hard labor, and were also dishonorably discharged and meant to suffer the punishments, as they said, thereof. So what happened eventually at the end of the war is these sentences were commuted, and the men were eventually had their sentences reduced almost entirely, because the Navy understood that after the war that leniency was warranted, so did away with their sentences. But the mutineers were never given veterans benefits, and the felony account was never erased from their records. So it was something that haunted many of them for the rest of their lives.
And we have never seen a case of that kind of, whether you want to call it mutiny or collective disobedience since then in the military?
Not prior to or since then. The military avoided any charge reminiscent of mutiny or strenuously. It represented kind of a collapse of military laws and rules and regulations, and it certainly wasn't publicized. But the Navy made a strong effort to publicize the mutiny trial in the case of the Port Chicago 50.
And like you said, it showed the sort of dark underbelly of this war.
Yes, it did.
The name of the book is The Color of War, How One Battle Broke Japan and Another Changed America. It's by our guest today, James Campbell. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you very much.
I'm Norman Gilliland with Emily Auerbach, and I hope you'll join us for the next hour of University of the Air.